You're listening to the Clean Comedy Podcast with James Creviston and Luke LaCoy.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Clean Comedy Podcast. This is James, and today I'm here with my co-host, Mr. Luke LaCoy.
Hello.
Hello. And today is book club day. Yay. I don't, should we do jazz hands? I don't know. All right. It's book club day. And this last month's book club was, the book of the month was Judd Apatow's Sick in the Head. I was interviewed with a ton of comedians. It's a book I read pretty much every year. It's one of my favorites. I always find some gems in there. Well, I always love reading the Seinfeld interview. I always love reading the Steve Martin interview. There's just so many good interviews in there. So the book is really Judd Apatow interviewing comedians, because that's how Judd Apatow got his love and start of comedies. He started interviewing comedians for his newspaper in high school. And he's built relationships with these guys. I say guys, there are some girls in there too. And then talk to them later on and stuff. And so these are later interviews for most of them. But in every single one of them, there is a little nugget of gold. And I'm just going to talk about like some that I really, really enjoyed. And it just happened to be based on what's happening in my life now and kind of where I am and what happened with comedy and those kind of things. But they really touched me differently this time reading the book. I think anybody who's a comedian, it doesn't matter what comedians you like or don't like or whatever, there is an interview in this book for every single comedian or comedy lover, because every single one of them will touch you in a different way. It'll make you see something differently. It'll make you understand comedy differently. It'll give you a different perspective. It'll probably lift you up a little bit. It might make you think more about what you're doing, just that kind of stuff. But overall, the book is not like a book. It's not a novel. Like, you're not reading a story. You're just reading a bunch of interviews, which most people would say, oh, that's boring, but there's not. There's like these little nuggets in there that really lift you up. One of the ones that really stuck out to me is with Chris Rock today. And I'm just going to read the exchange, because Judd Apatow says to Chris Rock, do you get the urge to stand up again because you feel like the culture has changed and you have something new to say? Or is it just like, okay, I guess it's time to start thinking about a special again? And this is what I think is gold here, okay? So from Chris Rock. Comes from having something to say. Comes from being a new person. Have you lived enough life? Are you seeing the world differently? It can be something as simple as getting up on stage and talking about your kids. I don't really talk about my kids in my last special, but the special before that, I was talking about them being born and keeping her off the pole. That's a great Chris Rock joke if you don't know that joke. You know what I mean? So if I decide to talk about her tomorrow, 12 years will have passed. I'll be talking about a 13-year-old kid. You're talking about a different person, a different life experience. And that's a big thing, is we as comedians, we should be living life. If we're sitting at home trying to write jokes and all we do is go between work, jokes, club, we're not living life. We're not going on vacations. We're not going to places. We're not trying new meals. We're not trying new experiences. We're not doing any of that stuff. So we really have to be like on point. We have to be thinking about what we see in the world. We should be watching the world, analyzing it, and bringing it back. Luke and myself and David all went with our families to Downtown Disney, and we were cracking jokes amongst ourselves about stuff going on, because we're living in the moment. We're living there. We're enjoying it. We're laughing at what's going on, right? Would you agree that that's important?
I want to live in Downtown Disney. That's what
I would have to end up. The only way I would live in Downtown Disney, if I got to break the Beast Lego statue down, or they removed it or something. Like, that's it. And they built a Gaston one there, then I'd be okay. If you don't know that story and all that stuff, you should go check out the Disney Tonight Show podcast. We talk about my dislike of Beast and my love of Gaston, and it's a really interesting time, and there's lots of funny stuff there. But did you feel like we could make jokes, we could be funnier, we could have more fun together, because we were living in the moment together? You think that helped?
Yeah, and also I think we're always thinking of jokes, even if we're, not actively doing it. So, I think it's just something that's natural to us.
Yeah. Does your wife tell you to, like, all right, cut it out, no more jokes, like, don't do that? Like, because I'll make jokes wherever we're going. Like, I don't care where I am. I'll just make fun of stuff or just make, just want to make other people laugh just because, you know, I like it.
I'm not as active as you are. That's for sure. But I, you know, I do a lot of lame jokes that don't get a laugh, and then I have to deal with it. And then, you know, like, what, that was funny. And then, no, it wasn't funny. You know, so like, oh, all right.
Wait till you have kids. Then jokes that you make, they won't, they'll be like, that's stupid. That's lame, Dad. Why would you make that? That's not even funny. And I was like, well, that's totally funny.
I'm almost, I kind of got that right now.
So. Yeah, yeah. But I mean, when they can talk, when they're a baby, they'll still laugh at your jokes. I don't care. But when they can talk and they like can get back to them, like, that's not funny. You know, what's funny is my kids' friends think I'm funnier than my kids do. My kids don't think I'm that funny, but my kids' friends think I'm hilarious. And I've had like some of their friends be like, oh, I saw your stand up on YouTube and it's funny. And I was like, okay, cool. You know, well, my kids are like, you're not that funny. You're not funny at all. Like, whatever, I guess, you know, maybe they're too close to the situation.
Mm-hmm.
But I like how Chris Rock said you have to have something to say. You have to live life. You have to have experiences to get up to go do stand-up. Like, I know that my stand-up from when I first started, the jokes I write in my stand-up now are two different kinds of stand-up. They're not the same thing. I don't talk about the same thing. I don't talk about the same experiences. It's just you have to live life. There's a lot of comedians who – only, like I said, do those three things of like work, write some jokes, go to do stand up. Work, write some jokes, go to, and that's not bad. You're hustling, you're getting stage time, you're doing things. But what are you really talking about? What are you really covering? Talking about you're doing Tinder jokes and President Biden or President Trump jokes or whatever president we have, and you're talking about dating and you're talking about Uber drivers and whatever. It's all material that everyone knows and it's not gonna be fresh. But you know, you went to Magic Mountain for the weekend with you know, your sister and her two kids, and all these weird things happen. Talk about that stuff. Let's talk about that, because that's, everybody has those moments of like, oh no, I'm with people that I should, like, I'm the odd person out here and this is what I'm seeing, you know, whatever it is. And so that kind of stuff. Go ahead, you have more stuff?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting with the book too. It's kind of like a dictionary, so it's, you have to kind of like thumb through to see like what interviews you're interested in, and like you kind of touched on it. What was interesting is that he started this, you know, like, was it in high school he started doing interviews?
Yeah, yeah, for his his newspaper, he like tricked comedians into like letting him do interviews. I think one of his first ones is like also Jerry Seinfeld.
Yeah, and it wasn't necessarily tricking. Like, he was saying like, oh, he's a writer for a paper, he would love to do an interview, and then he would show up at their house and like as a kid.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really, you know, interesting, and you know, it shows that there is no age. Like, when you want to start something or learn about something, there is no age to get into it. It's just you have to do it. And I think it was Jerry that was his first one, and then he thought it was kind of funny, you know, that this kid showed up and he did the interview anyway.
Yeah, and they became friends amazing. And stuff. So it's awesome. The other thing that I liked about this is, and again, I love Chris Rock, so that's probably why this stuck out to me more. But Chris Rock talks about one thing that comedians do when they have a bad night. What have you heard comedians say when they've had a bad show?
I don't want to say it here.
just say it in a nice. Can you say it in a nice way?
Probably never doing stand up again.
All right, that one, or they'll be like, oh, the crowd sucks tonight. That crowd sucked. They didn't get my jokes, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. So, where was it? Dang it. Okay. So Chris Rock's, they're talking about doing stand-up. He goes, you know, the thing is where it's just like, it literally doesn't matter who's in front of you. I find more and more comedians complain about the crowd these days. They're always asking, how's the crowd? And I'm like, why do you care about the crowd? I mean, if you kill the night, is the crowd going to get the credit? And so don't give it to them if you bomb. It's not them. It's you. We have a lot more comedy, but there's not a lot of people doing a lot of risk-taking anymore. So he's talking about, like, how we, you know, comedians will literally blame the audience for their jokes sucking. Like, oh, you didn't get that joke. You guys don't get it. Whatever. You're not cool. I've heard comedians do that. I'm like, what are you doing? Like, obviously you didn't write the joke right, or you're not delivering it right. It's not them. It's you. You didn't deliver the thing they want. If someone walks out of a movie and they go, ah, that movie sucked, the director's like, oh, you never made a movie before. Like, you don't get movies. They suck. You know, it's like right now, Kevin Smith is blaming people for not liking the new He-Man show where there's no He-Man in it. You can't come. What? You can't get mad about that. Like, you can't get mad at the audience for the thing that you're not doing right. If you're not doing things right, guess what? It's your fault. If you don't deliver a joke right, you don't do the setup properly, you don't do the punchline, or you didn't give context, whatever it is, it's not going to work and people are not going to understand. And guess what? They're not going to laugh. It's not them. It's you. That's the biggest thing. It drove me nuts. Go ahead. I'll let you go.
Wow. That's some strong words from a strong man.
I just don't like people complaining about comedy when it's like, look, you can, it's on you. If you mess up, it's on you.
Mm-hmm. And that's true. It's, you know, I think it's an ego thing when the blame is taken out directly on the audience. It's like, it's almost like, you know, it's the mentality that everyone's there to see you.
Right. Right?
And at an open mic, nope. No one's there to see you.
I always assume at an open mic, I am going to bomb. And the reason why is because everyone's there in their own head thinking about what they're going to say on stage. So they're not paying attention to you. So you can't use an open mic as a bomb. What you can use an open mic or as a way to gauge yourself, what you can use the open mic to do is record yourself doing that set, listen to it, and find out where you messed up, where you slowed down, where you didn't enunciate, all that kind of stuff. So when you do it in front of a real crowd, you know what you're doing right. An open mic is not going to give you the feedback you want. Sadly, it's sad that that's the truth. It's just there for you to get more stage time. It's like my daughter is about to start taking driver's ed. My oldest daughter is about to start taking driver's ed. She's going to get time behind the wheel with an instructor. That's not the same as her going on a road trip. Okay. It's not the same experience. It's not driving. It's not even really driving. It's like being under the tutelage of somebody else while they teach you to drive. Yes, you go around on the same streets. Yes, you do all the same stuff, but you're not really a driver yet. You're kind of like in that practice mode. And this guy or this person that's in the car with you, all they want to do is make sure that you follow the proper steps and that you're doing what you're supposed to do. And your main focus is to learn how to drive. This is just like, I just got to have to make sure I figure this out. That's all an open mic is, just figuring out, how do I steer this thing? How do I get these set up right? So that then when I go on the trip, the fun drive, it's fun. It's not scary. It's not hard. It's not difficult, you know, all that stuff. Because that's what the mic is. The mic is your practice mode, and the show, it should be your fun mode. You should be going. And also, if you go into a show and go, oh man, it's gonna suck, if you think every show's gonna suck, stop doing comedy, okay? Because it should not suck. This should be fun, right? Yes, it is a job. Yes, you can get paid. Yes, you, big things can happen. But if you think every show's gonna suck, or you come out of every show saying that show sucked, you need to reevaluate what you're doing, because that is ridiculous. We're getting to do the most fun job in the world. Make people laugh, right? People pay other people to make people laugh. It's insane. I don't understand, I guess.
I have a quick driver's ed story.
All right, let's hear it.
So the first time whoever the teacher is, they picked me up from my high school, and it was like a car loaded of us. And then I was driving, and it was my first time I got onto a freeway. And so I didn't know the protocol, so I just gunned it, and then I just gunned it on the freeway, and I got on. And she's like, "Next time you might want to look over your shoulder to see that the lane is open." I was like, "Oh, okay."
Did you almost kill everybody in the car?
Is that what happened? Well, I don't know. I mean, I was on the side of the road for a while.
Wait, was that the first? Was that the first time you ever drove
onto a freeway?
Oh, onto a freeway, but not like driving. So you're used to merging and stuff like that.
Sure.
Okay. So in Vegas, that's where I got my license. They didn't require driver's ed stuff.
Oh.
So you could just go take the written test at 15 and a half and get your permit, and then you could drive. So the person that taught me to drive was my dad. He was not calm about driving. So one day we wanted to drive from one side of Vegas to the other side of Vegas, which isn't a big deal, but he wouldn't let me take the freeway. So we had to do all surface streets, which was fine. But then anytime I needed to make a turn, my dad would like freak out about me like watching for people to turn in my lane or whatever. So one time I had to make a right turn, and he was like, "Watch for pedestrians." Oh, no, he's yelling at me. And so someone started walking up the sidewalk. They weren't crossing, but they walk up the sidewalk, and he's freaking out on me. So I just ran the car into the sidewalk, at like a 7-Eleven and got out of the car and started walking. I was like, I'm done. Like, so that was like the moment I was like, I'm not learning from you anymore. I don't want to drive with you anymore. I want nothing to do with this. So that was like, it was super intense. I just remember getting, he's like yelling at me, like, get back in the car. And I'm like, I'm not getting back in the car. I don't care. I'll take a cab. I'll walk, whatever. I'll hitchhike. I don't care. I'm not getting back in the car. And I didn't either. I walked to like, he got out of the car, drove to where we were supposed to be going. And I just like walked there. He's like, now what are you going to do? And I was like, I don't know. I haven't figured it out yet. He's like, well, you better think. And then I had a friend that like lived like in the area that just drove me home. Cause I was like, I'm not good enough. And I don't think I ever did any like driving stuff with him again, ever. So I was like, yeah, I'm not doing that. But on the first day that I got my first car, I got two tickets by the same cop. Okay, so here's what happened. So I bought my uncle took me to go buy my first car. It was a Volkswagen Bug. It was a 67 Super Beetle. So I drive it. First of all, I don't know how to drive a stick shift. All Volkswagen Bugs are stick shifts. So I'm in downtown Las Vegas on mostly one-way streets trying to learn how to drive a stick shift for a car I'm about to buy for $1,750. So $1,750 at the time. So I'm learning down the streets, and the guy's like, you're doing a great job. You're doing a great job. Like this car salesman guy. I was like, okay. So I get back, and he's like, oh, are you going to buy it? And I was like, Mike was like, just buy the car. I'll just follow you home. I was like, fine. So I bought this car. I drive home. I park it down the street because I wasn't supposed to buy a car yet. Like my dad's mom was like, you can't buy a car yet. You need to wait or whatever. So I park it down the street. Then I have to go get it registered. Well, I go to get it registered. And as I drive to the place, I get pulled over by a motorcycle cop. Motorcycle cop asks me where I'm going. I say, I'm going to the DMV. Here's all my paperwork. He's like, well, you don't have any you don't have your license and stuff. So I'm going to have to give you a ticket. I'm like, I'm going to the DMV to get that stuff. Like that's what part of that doesn't make sense to you? He's like, sorry, I got to give you a ticket. I'm like, whatever. So I get to the DMV. They tell me I need another paper, right? Before I can register my car, I have to go like do a smog thing or whatever. So I have to drive back to my house. I drive the same route, get pulled over by the same cop, writes me another ticket for the same stuff. I was like, come on, bro. Like, I remember getting home and just being like, my dad's like, what's wrong? I'm like, I got two tickets. He's like, how'd you get two tickets? You just had to drive. I'm like, by the same cop. I got two tickets by the same cop for the same thing. He's like, that dude just wanted to write you a ticket. I ended up getting him dropped eventually, but it was like still annoying that I got two tickets from the same cop. So speaking of stops and seeing people and kind of like doing that, do you remember the Steve Martin story for the way Judd Apatow first meets Steve Martin?
I don't think I read that one.
Okay. So Judd Apatow lived on, obviously, like in New York and on the East Coast, and he had an aunt who lived in California. And he looked up where Steve Martin's house was. So this is the 1980s. So they drive by the house, and Judd Apatow with his aunt sees Steve Martin outside his house and yells at her to stop. So they stop. He jumps out or whatever. He jumps out. He runs up to him. He says, hey, can I get your autograph? He says, no, I'm sorry. I don't sign autographs at my house. So Judd says, well, okay. Then can you sign it in the street? Right? That's pretty good. He says, no. He said, sorry, he didn't sign autographs at his house because if he did, then everybody would walk up to his front door and ask for things, and that wouldn't be good. I didn't understand the logic at the time. So he's like, please, 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 I'm out of town. I'm from out of town. I won't tell anyone where you live. I'll never bother you again. But Steve Martin wouldn't sign his thing. So Judd got back in the car, went back with his aunt, went straight home, went to his room, and wrote him this like long, crazy letter, and then had her take it back. And he also demanded an apology in the letter. He went back to his house and stuck the, you know, letter in the mailbox. He didn't mail it. He like stuck it in his mailbox. So about 6 months later, long after he stopped thinking about how he's wronged, he received a package in the mail, which contained two copies of Cruel Shoes, which was Steve Martin's semi-annual collection of essays and short stories. And one of the copies he wrote, this is for your friend, Steve Martin. That friend, of course, was his brother who didn't appreciate it. And then he has the other one said to Judd, I'm sorry, I didn't realize I was speaking to the Judd Apatow, your friend Steve Martin. So that's how he first met Steve Martin, and then they became friends or whatever and stuff like that. But like, that's pretty funny. Like, I've had those moments of meeting a celebrity, and it being an awkward moment where you're like, do I say something? Do I not say something? Like, what do I do in this moment? You know what I'm saying? Where you're like, oh, okay. So there was a show that I liked for a while called Blackish, and the lead was Anthony Anderson. And I had to go for a work thing on a flight somewhere. And I sit down at the like waiting area, and I look across from me, and literally sitting right across from me is Anthony Anderson, like eating something. And I was like, holy cow. And I was like, Mr. Anderson, like whispering, Mr. Anderson. And he like doesn't look at me, and I go, Dre, Dre, because that was the name on the show. And he kind of looks up at me. I was like, come on. I was like, hey, how's it going? He just kind of nods at me. So I was like, all right, that's cool. So I left the world. I was like, all right, I'm done. So I was like, I got my nod, I got my acknowledgement, I'm okay. Then and someone else notices him and comes up and says, hey, can I take a picture with you? And he says, only if she could take a picture with me too. Like, I think it was his mom or something like that. And she's like, oh, I don't want to, I don't want to. And he's like, well, then, I'm not gonna take a picture with you, whatever. And the guy's like, come on, man, come on. And he's like, nah, sorry, like that's the, I'm making the rule. I was like, okay. So then we're sitting there, and I'm still like kind of staring at him like awkwardly, like it's weird. I'm sure he's like, this dude's a creep. And I'm looking at him and I go, what would I have to do to get a selfie with you or whatever? Like, did I need to get somebody else involved? Like, I'll get this person. I'll grab everybody if you want. And he just starts laughing and he's like, nah, it's cool. So we take a picture together or whatever. I still have it on my phone. And I think I posted on like whatever social media ahead of the time or whatever. And then, but when I sit down next to him, I left my boarding pass next to him. So I was like, so giddy or whatever. That like, I was like, woo. And then he's like, finishes stuff. And then he gets up to go to his plane, because he's going to a different plane, and he sees my boarding pass. He goes, hey, you forgot your boarding pass. And I was like, oh my gosh, thank you so much. And he's like, all right, no worries, bye. And he just like left. And I was like, that was such a cool interaction. I'm sure it was creepy to him, but it was such a cool interaction for me. And I just realized, like, the more celebrities I meet, the more people I meet, because I met like all kinds of different stand-up comedians that are like big, Adam Conover, who does Adam Ruins Everything. I met him at a club. We talked for a few minutes, told him how much I appreciated his show, whatever. I was just like really kind of cordial and kind about it. But I realized that's how you be. You can't be like, oh my gosh, like when you do that, it's like, okay, I don't want to be around you because now you're going to attract more attention. Now you're going to be weird. Now it's going to be awkward, So if you meet a celebrity, just say, hey, I just want to say hi. Thank you so much for whatever, blah, blah, blah. I love this thing about you and have a great day. And then boom, gone. If they say, sometimes they'll be like, hey, you want to take a selfie? Like some will be cool like that. So I'm like, okay, cool. Just keep going. So it just really depends on who you're doing with. I don't know.
Wasn't there someone you saw at like an airport and you knew, or you weren't sure if it was them and you just started like yelling their name? Was that you? It was some like somewhere, either airport or like grocery store, you saw someone famous and you were like 50% sure it was them, and then I thought you were just like yelling their name just to see if they would turn in a.
I don't know. I did do that to Cinco Paul one time. I was at the grocery store.
I think yeah, it was I
Was it
think
that one?
that's yeah.
And I was like, Cinco, Cinco, Cinco Paul. And he like stops and like turns around and looks all weird, like, who is this? I was like, you're Cinco Paul, right? And he's like, yes. And I was like, I'm a big fan, whatever. He's like, okay. He's like, how do you know what I look like? Like that is creepy status. To be fair, okay, for everyone who doesn't know, he's a writer, so no, who's gonna know what he looks like? Most people don't have no clue what any writers look like unless they do stuff in front of the camera. But I am aware of him, more aware of him probably than anyone, because he also knows people in my wife's family. So like, I am more aware of what he looks like. I wouldn't be able to identify every single writer. Like, Matt Greening, I probably would. Like, I'd probably be able to identify some big writers, like, Mike Judge, I'd probably be able to identify him. Like, just like people that you maybe not see on the screen that much. So I don't know. But yeah. But yeah, that might be the story that you're
I
thinking
think
of.
that was,
And Seagull was cool about it. Like, he was really cool. He didn't. And I was like, okay, have a nice day. And I just walked away. He was just, I'm sure he was like, this is the most awkward interact. You didn't ask me for an autograph. You asked me for a photo. You didn't, nothing. You just said, wanted to say hi and I like your stuff and then leave. Like, but you like yelled my name like 10 times. And he was like, yeah, I'm sure. Point is, don't do that.
Yeah.
So, all right. So what's your biggest takeaway from the book? Like, what's the thing that that you think about more about this book? And would you ever read it again?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely other interviews. Well, when I can get it checked out in the library again.
Yes.
there's other interviews I'd be interested in checking out. I thought the one with, oh, was it Spike Jones?
Yeah.
That was excellent because I didn't know Spike Jones' background was in, was it BMX? Or like doing BMX
Yes.
videos or skateboard videos. And then from there he went to, like directing these amazing comedies. So just like seeing people's history and where they started from and then where they ended up, that was really motivating. Especially for, all those guys, like either starting in stand up or starting in directing, and then just the progress that they did. And I didn't know too that Judd had lived with Adam Sandler
Yeah, they were
either.
friends, really good friends, yeah.
Yeah, I had no idea. So then like the whole thing just started to make sense. Like, oh, okay, like a lot of what they had done together started to click. And so that was cool for me just to see like how all those connections were made, and then the progression that they all went through together. So that was probably the biggest like motivating factor for me,
Yeah.
just reading all of
Yeah. And that's the thing is there's not one path, right? There's not one
that.
path to the thing that you want to do. There's a lot of different ways to get there, and I'm finding more and more people reaching out to me about stuff that I do, like because they're like, oh, I'm interested in doing that. And I was like, oh, I didn't, that was not my goal. Like, I didn't want to do this thing, but it just happened to be a byproduct of whatever I'm doing. So now, like I'm making web stuff for like doing stand up for like different companies or writing different things for games or, whatever stuff that I like would never normally have thought I would do. Is now possible. Like there's an opportunity for me to write possibly, I don't know if it's gonna happen, but write for a really popular YouTube channel that's about Magic the Gathering. And I love Magic the Gathering. Like it's super fun. In fact, my wife said to me the other day, like, she's like, what happens when you go on tour and you can't play Magic? I'm like, no, what I'm gonna do is anybody who goes on tour with me, I'm gonna give them a Magic the Gathering deck and so we could play. Cause I'm not gonna not play. Like I want to play. She's like, you're just gonna give them I'm like, yeah, I just built, like, I'll know who they are. I'll build them a deck based on what I think they might like, and then we'll play Magic the Gathering together. She's like, that's so weird. I'm like, whatever. Like, because there are like tour buses where they play, people play video games together or whatever. So it's like, if I'm gonna go on tour with somebody, I wanna be able to, like, we could do other stuff, but I also wanna be able to do the thing that I also like too. And maybe I'll get somebody to like it. Maybe they'll hate it. Probably not, because once you play it and you understand, it's fun. And so, that's what I would do. Like, if you and me and David went, I would make both of you your own decks. It wouldn't come out of your pocket. It wouldn't cost you anything. I'll make you your own deck of Magic, and then we would just play together. You would like it. I promise. I promise you, like, I promise you, like it.
I can't see David playing Magic.
I would get David to play Magic. David Studebaker will play Magic. That is my pledge to the world. I don't know how I'm gonna get him to do it, but I'll get him to do it. I think he would like it, actually. Because he's really smart. Like, he's an intellectual person, and that game's a very intellectual game. And he also likes to win at stuff. So I think
That's
for
true.
him, it
That's
would
true.
be fun. And he does like games. Like, he does like games, so I think he would enjoy it.
Yeah, just get some money involved. He'll probably participate.
I don't want to do that. That game, that's one game I would never want to bet on because you've never, I mean, literally. You can't bet. It'd be so hard to bet on Magic because there's so many factors involved. Because if it's one versus one, like you can kind of guess or whatever, but when you're playing, usually you play commander, at least that's what I play, in groups of four. You can't do it that way. It has to be different. All right. Anyways, so we'll talk about what we're doing off, like outside of comedy in a different episode. We'll do that one for next week. How about that? So, Luke, where can people find you?
Luke LaCoy on the socials and the Fivers and the Upworks and
Awesome.
whatever everywhere.
Everywhere. And you can find me, jamesdcrevison.com. You can find me, James D. Crevison, on Fiverr and the Upworks as well. You can find me and more stuff on comedypreneur.com. And check out our YouTube channel. If you're not watching this on YouTube, go check it out. Please like, subscribe there. We need more subscribers. We want to get to 1,000. So if you know people you want to give advice or let them be entertained or whatever, please share. All right. We need 1,000 subscribers. We're getting a lot of views, but we're not getting the subscribers. I don't know what I'm doing wrong. But please, please, please like, share, subscribe, and have a great week. Bye.